Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa School of Social Work, offering the opportunity to earn a master's degree from anywhere in Iowa, including an all-online MSW program. Information at socialwork.uiowa.edu.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. James Autry grew up in the segregated Deep South in Mississippi. He came of age during the Civil Rights Movement, and like so many other liberal-minded white Southerners, he moved north. This summer, while so many Americans have been participating in a renewed movement for racial equality and social justice, Autry's been thinking about his cousin, Douglas Autry. He stayed in Mississippi. He worked to integrate the local schools and create educational opportunities for all of the children of Benton County, Mississippi. Autry has written about his cousin in the book, The White Man Who Stayed, and he is with me now. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today. And first, take me back in time to Benton County, Mississippi. What was it like when you were growing up?
Well, it was very segregated, to say the least. We had separate schools, separate churches, and there was not the hostility in our part of the state that you found in others. Generally, it was a pretty placid place until the civil rights movement heated up later. But I did all the things that boys did. Now, let it be said, I did not go to school in the rural Mississippi. I had been born in Memphis, and after divorce, my father moved to Mississippi. I stayed in Memphis with my mother until college days. So, but I was there quite a bit, frequency of visits for seeing my dad on the, you know, not just weekends, but sometimes for long spaces in the summer. So I had quite a lot of experience with everyday Mississippi life. And it was not, you know, it was not filled with the hostility that you might imagine. What was our relationship with African Americans? Sort of benign, you know. I played with those boys. We hunted and fished together. We did everything like that. But we sure didn't eat together. We didn't go to school together. We didn't go to church together. We didn't do anything institutional. But there was a lot of personal experiences and good times. I remember fishing with black kids and playing around the country store. And, you know, you hardly noticed the difference in race until puberty. Puberty was a big turning point in the racial relations.
In what way?
We were just expected to not associate very much with black kids after we got to be in puberty because of the perceived sexual tension. I don't know that it was there, but older people didn't want us associating after puberty with black girls or black boys with white girls. It just was, that was one of those things that was sort of the red flag and the turning point for those relationships. Until that time, it had been pretty benign. And then after that, when you got to more adults, we did things still, hunted and fished with black men and had a generally positive relationship. My father was a Southern Baptist minister, as was my grandfather. And when they had revival meetings in the summer, which is, you know, the great come-to-Jesus meetings, Dad was a powerful preacher. The black people would stand around outside the church with the windows open, and it was hot as it could be, and white and black people, but a lot of black people out there came to hear my father preach. And we went to their churches, too, standing outside. It was a strange sort of segregation because socially we were so connected, and this is true of all of us. We connect better in times of sadness than we do in some times of joy. So with a house burning or somebody getting killed or something, the community sort of gathered, and it wasn't very segregated when that happened. they didn't go into the church together and that sort of thing, but it was not hostile. And I think there's a great image in the North of the South always being hostile between the races. Now, I'm speaking from a white person's viewpoint.
Right.
It could be that African American boys felt it different from the way I felt. And my goodness, when I was in college, the races were completely segregated. There were no interracial mixing or dating. Of course, one of the things people don't realize is there, Mississippi has more elected black officials now than any state in the Union. And the University of Mississippi is very segregated. The president, the student body, the cheerleaders, you know, it's they've all been African American. And in fact, Miss Ole Miss, which is a beauty contest at the university, has been held by a black girl. And what's interesting about that is that only about 12% of that student body is black. So you can see that younger people have a little more open and tolerant attitude. And nowadays, the university, the faculty, it's all very, very integrated. And you would not know it to go on one of those campuses that it was a great segregated society. But when you went outside those cities, like Oxford or Jackson, and got out in the rural areas, it's still very much the way it was when I grew up, except there's more general hostility, I feel.
Let's talk about the structure that created this reality that you grew up in. Bill Moyers wrote a foreword for your book, and he really does a beautiful job putting the racist laws of the American South in perspective. And he points out that Hitler actually took inspiration from the Jim Crow laws, believing that Germany could take a similar approach to what they called the Jewish problem. So this fairly benign feeling culture that you grew up in was the result of just an incredibly racist society built on violence.
Absolutely. And looking back on it now, with an adult's perspective, I see that. I see that there was considerable segregation even among the kids when we thought we were integrated. I mean, our parents watched over that pretty carefully. I think that it was never utterly benign. There were always the violations of quote, whatever the code might be. And, black people didn't usually come to the front door, for instance. They generally were always the servants. And they were the people who did the most menial chores you could get. Looking back on it, I see that all kinds of subtle and not so subtle ways, there was sort of an intense segregation within which I grew up, not recognizing it until I got to college.
And you after you graduated from college, you moved north. You left Mississippi behind and Tennessee as well.
Yeah, well, after I graduated from college, I'd been in ROTC. I went through pilot training. I became a jet fighter pilot and went to France for 3 years. And then after I came back from France and got out of the service, I moved back to the South and stayed there only 2 or 3 months until I got a chance to go to work for Better Homes and Gardens in Des Moines, Iowa. I jumped at that. And so I left the South and after college and then came back for just a few months. And then in 1960, moved to Des Moines, where I've lived ever since. Now, I've stayed in touch with people in the South. I have relatives down there. And I followed closely what's gone on there, but I haven't lived there. And I haven't had to deal with the issues that the white people who stayed or never got to leave had to deal with.
We'll explore the story of one of those people who stayed in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. I'm talking to James Autry. His most recent book is The White Man Who Stayed, A Biography Remembered. He's written about the life of his cousin, Douglas Autry, a man who did stay and worked hard to integrate the schools in Benton County, Mississippi. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa School of Social Work, offering the opportunity to earn a master's degree from anywhere in Iowa, including an all-online MSW program. Information at socialwork.uiowa.edu.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Right now I'm talking with James Autry. He lives in Des Moines. He's worked in Des Moines for decades now, but he spent a big part of his childhood in Benton County, Mississippi. And his most recent book is about his cousin, Douglas Autry, who stayed and spent his career in Benton County, Mississippi. He worked hard to integrate the local schools and create educational opportunities for all of the children of Benton County, Mississippi. The book is called The White Man Who Stayed, A Biography Remembered, out from Ice Cube Press. And Jim, tell me a little bit about your family, because your family has deep roots in Mississippi, and it's fascinating to learn about your father, his brothers and sisters, and really the very different paths that some of them took through life. So give us a thumbnail sketch of the Autry family.
There were five siblings, three sons and two daughters. The sons were my father, the minister, Ewart, E-W-A-R-T, his brother, Eland, who is the father of the protagonist in my book, E-L-O-N-D, and the younger brother, who is something of a ne'er-do-well and an alcoholic. His name is Everson, E-V-E-R-S-O-N. And the daughters were named Ruvis and Valena. Now, don't ask where those names came from. One time I asked my mother, she said, well, they're out of the Bible. I don't think you could find them, but there was always an answer.
Right.
So my father, the minister, was a great peacemaker. He was always trying to keep the peace, you know. So he never would engage the racial issues directly. He was... And I used to give him a hard time about that. His brother, Eland, was a white supremacist of the first order. I mean, he served in the Mississippi legislature. He was supportive of Theodore Bilbo, the infamous senator, who actually stood up in the Congress and said, we should give the black folks a nickel and put them on a boat to Africa, and the Jews will follow them to get the nickel. That's the kind of supremacist, white supremacist he was. Mm. And he is the father of the protagonist. And then there was Everson, the younger brother. And he plays a role in the story, too. It's interesting that when Douglas, about whom I wrote the book, became superintendent of education and worked to get the schools integrated, he had a great influence on Uncle Eland, the white supremacist, who all of a sudden decided to become president of the school board. He became president of the school board, and he was holding biracial committee meetings in his home to work toward integrating the schools. And that was the first time I suspected a black person had ever been in that house. It's kind of an interesting turn. He was converted by the influence of his beloved son, Douglas.
Where do you think Douglas's ideas came from? Because, he grew up in this segregated culture where everyone, at least everyone white, accepted what was going on. And that was the way that it was. That was the way it was supposed to be. Where did he start to change his ideas, do you think?
Can I take a minute and just read the first paragraph of the book?
Sure.
Which might throw some light. I can make this quick. The facts are simple enough. Country boy goes to war, comes home changed, goes to college, moves back to Mississippi home county, wins election as superintendent of education, makes political enemies, makes naive mistakes, gets set up, tried, and convicted to 7 years in Mississippi's Parchman Farm. Senate suspended after 18 months, returns home, later goes to work in a federal program to help black and poor white people, endures harassment and cross burnings by the Klan, is supported by the black community, and once again elected to superintendent of education, endures more harassment while overseeing school integration, retires, and dies. That is the story in one paragraph and one sentence. So, Douglas, who knows? I think maybe he saw a lot of combat in World War II. He was on the picket line of in the destroyer in the Solomon Islands fighting kamikazes, you know, suicide bombers.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me he thought he was going to die several times because these planes were coming right at his ship, and he was a gunner and trying to hit them. So I don't know. Maybe somewhere in all that blood and noise and acrid smells of gunpowder, he got some sort of experience that somehow made the difference in color between people not very important to him. And then he had the 4 years at the University of Missouri, which was probably a more enlightening experience than he'd ever had in education before. Anyway, with all of that, he somehow came back and became really my hero. I mean, he was, of all the people in the family, he is my hero. Because he endured a lot of stuff. Now, I told you Uncle Everson, the youngest in the family. So there's Ewart, who's a preacher. There's Elon, who is had been a state legislator, white supremacist, later becoming head of the school board. And then there's Everson. Everson became head of the Ku Klux Klan in the county. So he and his boys who were harassing Douglas and burning crosses in front of Douglas's house and so on. So as Douglas used to say, Faulkner wasn't making anything up; he was just writing it down. So that's sort of the story of the family, and then his story in the midst of all that.
Yeah. Well, and you write about your uncle Everson harassing Douglas's wife. Someone drove a car at her and forced her off the road. And
yes,
he himself lambasting Douglas's teenage daughter and yelling at her in the street. So it was an incredibly contentious relationship between Douglas and his uncle. Let's talk a little bit about Douglas's work. And let's just tease the story of him getting set up and tried and going to prison for a while. People can dig into that when they read your book. But after that, he really experienced a second life, a second chance. Tell us about that.
Well, about the time he was getting out of prison, President Kennedy was elected, and he established the Community Action Program, which had consisted of the Peace Corps, the Neighborhood Youth Corps, Head Start, and those programs. And the woman who was named to head that federal program in the county was an African-American woman, because things changed pretty suddenly after that. So she, knowing Douglas's good work for the black people when he was superintendent of education earlier, before he went to prison, she hired him to head the Neighborhood Youth Corps. Now, the Neighborhood Youth Corps program was to take poor black and white kids who were failing in school or had dropped out and get them jobs with local businesses who were reimbursed by the federal government for the salary, and try to recycle them back into school. So this getting jobs also implied some training.
So Douglas set up with his associate there a training program, and it was set up so that the Neighborhood Youth Corps people, to get their checks, had to go to these classes. So Douglas sort of sneaked, used money to influence them to get an education. So some of those kids ended up going to college, incidentally. Wow. So it was quite a story, and because he worked impartially with the blacks and whites, he got the grudging support of the whites, but he got enthusiastic support from the black people, and it was they then who, after he got out of prison and worked in the Neighborhood Youth Corps and ran that in five counties, they who came to him and said, if you will run for superintendent of education, we will support you. So he didn't think he'd ever be able to serve in elected office again, but he had a full pardon. So he ran, and with their support, and with the support, I think, of a lot of people in the white community who realized he had been sort of set up and framed, he got elected by a very wide margin, had three consecutive terms as superintendent of education, and then retired, actually. And after he retired, unfortunately, he got sick with rheumatoid arthritis and died. But he had become a sort of a political power in the county, because the black people would listen to whatever he said. So it was quite a journey for him, but he had to endure a lot of things. When you think about a local boy who suddenly finds himself the object of hate from a lot of people he used to know and grew up with, you understand that it takes a lot of courage to stand up to that. And I mean, one of the blurb writers in the book, Clifton Talbert, who's an African American educator, lecturer, he commented about how much courage it took to go against what had been his way of life.
You write about, this is back before he ran for office again, he was running a Head Start program, and you went down to visit, and he said, hey, come, it's time for the kids to get out of Head Start. Come see what we're doing. And yeah. You write about that moment, and it's such a beautiful moment, but it also gives us a real insight into your cousin and what he was doing and what he was thinking. Tell us what you saw.
Well, we went to the headquarters, and it was time for the kids to be getting out of their classes, so the mothers were there. And on one side of the hall were the whites, and one side were the blacks. So the kids came out of the classroom holding hands, and black and white, no color difference, and playing together and enjoying one another. And from that, the mothers began to talk to one another, and the whole thing got to be very integrated. It got to get to be very much a community built on, mutual interest in their kids and the education of their kids. So that was a beautiful moment. And he came out, and before they came out, he said to me, sort of loud whisper, watch this. Because when the kids came out, they were all holding hands in this, completely an integrated mass of kids. And the mothers had to somehow respond to that.
It wasn't an easy fix, and it wasn't a complete fix. Obviously, we know that there are still many, many racial problems in the South and all over this country. But Doug did have an approach, and he was very thoughtful about it. It wasn't just a man implementing a program that he had been told to implement. You write about how he interacts with the mothers, and he makes sure that he is approaching every mother with the exact same amount of respect. And he was very thoughtful about that, because the white mothers would call him by his first name, but he would refer to each one of them as Mrs. So-and-so. And the black mothers would call him Mr. Autry, but he called each one of them Mrs. So-and-so, so that everyone was treated the same from his perspective.
And a lot of northern people, I don't think, would understand what a significant thing it was for him just to call the people Mr. and Mrs. When I was a copy boy working for the Commercial Appeal newspaper in Memphis, I remember seeing a delegation of African-American people came in and went into the editor's office, and I found out later all they were trying to do was get the newspaper refer to them as Mr. and Miss and Mrs. rather than by their first names. Mm. So that's how deep that thing that was. And I was impressed by that. And then Douglas always, he called his associate Mr. So-and-so, and everybody was, get the same amount of dignity and respect. And why? Because they're human beings and they all deserve it. And that was his attitude.
It sounds like such a small thing, but it was a revolutionary, a radical thing, a protest on his part that he was going to interact with the world in a different way than he'd been raised, in a different way than was considered to be normal.
Yeah, exactly. You've captured it very well. It seems like a small thing, but it was huge.
We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to James Autry, well known for his writing and his poetry. And his most recent book is called The White Man Who Stayed, A Biography Remembered, published by Ice Cube Press. And it's about his cousin, Douglas Autry, who stayed in Benton County, Mississippi, and worked hard to integrate the schools and make sure that every child in Benton County had an opportunity to get an education. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. My guest today is James Autry. And today we're talking about his family. His most recent book is called The White Man Who Stayed, A Biography Remembered. And it's about his cousin, Douglas Autry, who lived in Benton County, Mississippi, and worked hard to integrate the local schools and create educational opportunities for all of the children of Benton County, Mississippi. Jim calls him his personal hero. And Jim, why did you want to tell this story? Why did you write this book?
Well, because I was so deeply affected by it. When he was superintendent of education, I was in college. I was still in the midst of the segregated education that I had. And after that, after I got out and was in the Air Force and came back and saw what he had done in the 3 years that I was gone, it was pretty phenomenal. But I wanted to write about it because I saw what he was up against. I saw how he struggled. I saw how he maintained his dignity and his friends and throughout all of that. And I don't know, it just seemed to me it should be commemorated somehow. And the only way I have to commemorate something is with my words. So I was moved to write it. Also, he was not very well admired in the family. I mean, people loved him as families love one another, but he was not their favorite person. And because of his having been in prison, in some cases, he was just considered an outcast, even though he had got a commuted sentence and finally a full pardon.
So I wanted to tell this story not just because you wanted other people to know about him, but for the family as well?
Absolutely. I wanted to do something that was kind of a testimony that my family would read and maybe appreciate what they hadn't appreciated.
How did you collect the information because he was just living his life. You were far away, but you had to do extensive interviews to try to understand what he'd done and why he'd done it.
Yes, I did a lot of interviews with both African American people and white people, and dug into court records and went to find out about the trial. That was such a frame up, you know. He was accused of embezzling, and you know what he'd done is he'd taken money and moved it over from black to white, from white to black in the budget. And you know, if you've ever worked in any organization where you've got to deal with the budgets and keep them straight, you know that's a no-no, switching things from one account to another. So that's what he got in trouble for, and he was accused of embezzling for the grand total of $636. Sentenced to 7 years in Parchman Farm, which is an infamous prison, infamous throughout this country. As I say, his sentence was commuted after 18 months. He only served 18 months. And finally, he was pardoned after a couple, 3 years. But I went back and went into those records and interviewed people who worked for him, black and white, and it was quite a research project to be able to frame the information in a narrative way that fit my story. So it was more than just fascinating to me to be in that environment. I visited in some of those homes where I'd thought I'd never be when I was a kid, and that in itself was interesting. The love that the black people had for him, and the admiration that his co-workers had for him, just sort of was a revelation to me.
You know, in recent years, we have learned so much about the individuals who fought for civil rights in the South. And, you know, of course, when I was growing up, it was a pretty simple story that didn't go very, very deep. But in recent years, we have the opportunity, if it's something that we're willing to learn about, we have the opportunity to learn a great deal more about the men and women who stood up for their rights and fought for their rights and put their lives on the line. And of course, so many Black Americans lost their lives and just experienced terrible things during the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
and still do. Why do you think it's important to learn about your cousin who he did some revolutionary things, but he wasn't a firebrand. He wasn't on the front lines. He wasn't marching for rights. He was quietly creating change. Why is it important to tell his story right now?
Well, I think it's important because the story is being told as we live. And what was important to me is that so many people in the North where I live now have the black and white thing is a black and white story that only the white people are always the villains. And God knows there are a lot of villains, but there were white people who were also heroes. And I'm not sure that story has been told enough. As Bill Moyers says that in his introduction, he says there were others like him across the South. In time, there were many. They stayed for the hard, slow work of integration and racial justice. And I guess I was trying to write about one of those people. And as he says, sometimes they were successful and sometimes not.
Yeah. This summer, of course, we've seen a burgeoning civil rights movement in the wake of the murder of George Floyd. And yeah. We've seen a lot of white people stand up with black people and people of every background at a lot of protests this summer. But I've talked to a lot of Black Iowans who they're skeptical that support will continue. And, you know, they say, I was talking to someone just the other day who said every few years we seem to rediscover systemic racism and we learn about it and then nothing happens.
Yeah.
And if something is going to happen, especially here in Iowa, where 90% of the state is white, we all have to be invested in this. This is not a Black problem. It is not a problem for Black people to solve. It's an everybody problem. Do you think that there's something that we can all take away from your cousin Douglas's story in this moment?
I think the takeaway is that there's a sense of justice that we all need to develop. And he developed it. I think he developed it the hard way in combat. And there's a sense of equality, you know, that we have to develop. You know, it's so easy to demonize other people and to somehow trivialize their who they are and their lives and what they do. And I think what this book does is shows how one man, just one man, can make a huge difference for a community. I think that's the basic lesson here, which is that you don't have to be the head of a large movement. You can be one person working in a community and have a huge impact on what the future of that community is going to be, just by how people change. You know, I've often heard that if you've changed one person, you've changed the world. And I think that was Douglas's attitude. If he can help one of those kids get a job and be able to become part of society and get an education, if he could just help a few of them, or just one of them, a handful, that he's made a huge difference. And it was true. He did make a huge difference. What's not in that story is the number of times he borrowed money out of his own pocket, paid for kids to get the right clothing to come to school and things like that. It's filled with little stories, which are not, I don't tell in the book, but his wife refers to it. She says, we didn't have a lot of money, but Douglas was always giving it away.
and she learned about a lot of that after his death as well. He didn't even tell her about everything he did.
Yeah.
Maybe that was part of the secret to being able to do it.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for sharing this story. It is an inspiring one, and your cousin Douglas was a really special man. Thank you so much, Jim.
Thank you, Charity. I appreciate being with you.